The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Family Sanity with your host, Dr. Brian Stress. When you or a loved one are facing life's challenges, this hour could be your lifeline to understanding and improving your relationships. No matter your age, there is something here for you. Now, here is Dr. Brian Stress.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dr. Brian Stress. I'm a psychologist, and I'll be your host today for the our show, Family Sanity. Thanks for joining us today. On the show today, we're going to have two guests with us. The first guest is Ted Regalia. He's an accomplished pharmacist of over 30 years, and we'll talk a little bit more about him later. And then our second guest today will be Mark Mall, who's actually a professor for Kaplan University Health and Wellness Department. He has an extensive history in nutrition, and he's also works with children and adolescents. So today's topic is actually a topic that can be quite controversial, and it's something that I deal with frequently as a psychologist. The topic is about attentional difficulties. Attentional difficulties, or some people refer to it as ADD or ADHD, is one of the most common disorders diagnosed, which generally occurs in childhood and lasts through adolescence and adulthood. Common symptoms of this disorder can be difficulty paying attention, physical hyperactivity, difficulty controlling one's behavior. The symptoms, which is something we'll discuss here a little bit in a moment, is it's neurologically based as opposed to a cognitive choice or consequence of some sort or some other difficulty. There's no cure for neurologically based attentional difficulties, but symptoms may be reduced or even eliminated with proper diagnosis and treatment. I and my guests will assist to attempt to assist any listeners with understanding what really is attentional difficulties that requires treatment, and hopefully help help develop an understanding of what is or what are attentional difficulties that are not neurologically based. So, well, with that, we'll kind of start off with our topic here. So, once again, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is actually the proper diagnosis. Some people refer to neurologically based attentional difficulties as ADD. That's actually a term that is about 20 to 30 years old, and it's not really an active term within the medical community, whereas the current cookbook for diagnoses, which is basically the book that we use to what are the symptoms and proper diagnoses so that we all can be on the same page, the proper term is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder with hyperactivity, without hyperactivity, combined type. That means that the person has hyperactive behaviors and inattention, or hyperactivity, ADHD, NOS, which means they seem to have these attentional difficulties, but we're not really getting a good handle on them. So some of the symptoms of the disorder are being easily distracted, missing details, forgetting things, frequently switching from one activity to another, having significant difficulty focusing on one thing. The person with attentional difficulties may feel that they're bored after only a few minutes, which is kind of an excuse that people use when they have difficulty paying attention, having difficulty focusing attention on organizing and completing tasks or learning something new. Where one of the problems where attentional difficulties become prominent or noticed is when children or adolescents are having trouble completing or turning in their homework or assignments, when they lose things frequently. It's not uncommon that I interact with children, adolescents, and or even adults that they do their homework. It seems to get in their backpack or their binder, and it never makes it to the teacher. Very common symptom, unfortunately. The individual appears to have difficulty following verbal directions. They may be perceived as daydreaming, becoming easily confused. They may move slowly, have difficulty processing information as quickly and accurately as others, and struggling following multi-step directions. So basically what happens as a psychologist is I will have people call me in and ask for a assessment to assist in determining whether or not they actually have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder with or without hyperactivity. The other generally individuals call me whereas their parents are calling me when they have suspicions about their children or adolescents, or possibly their school has suggested to them that maybe their child has attentional problems of some sort. Adults call me when they basically are getting frustrated. They feel like they haven't been able to pay attention for a long time, as long as they can remember, and they just are frustrated. They want to do better, and they want to address that difficulty. So when it comes time to diagnose somebody with attention difficulties, pediatricians, other doctors, and psychologists participate in this task. So when I get that call, how I perform the assessment is, I of course look at collateral information such as medical records, school records, if available. I like to observe the patient in my waiting room. How do they act as soon as they arrive at my clinic? And then what we do is, what I do is an extensive, biopsychosocial history, which means basically I ask the patient and or their caregivers, their mother, father, grandmother, grandpa, anybody who, comes to the appointment with them as to what is their perception of the difficulties. Now, what we need to understand here, and I think a common problem with diagnosing attentional difficulties, is that people can choose not to pay attention as opposed to having a neurological deficit that refuses to allow them to pay attention or interferes with their ability to pay attention. The way I attempt to explain this to my patients and or to the children is I ask a mother or father, generally who's about 5'6" in height, if they can slam dunk a basketball. Generally, the mother or father cannot slam dunk a basketball. I then ask them if they could slam dunk a basketball if I give them $1 million. Most people respond that they would use a ladder or a trampoline or some sort of device to assist them. And I say, well, it's not really allowed, but can you slam dunk a basketball even if I give you $1 million? And the response generally is no. Now there are some people who are 5'6" in height who can slam dunk a basketball. They have specific nerve endings and muscle fibers, and they can basically jump like a kangaroo. The majority of us cannot do that. So the reason I tell this story or ask them these questions is that's the same thing with people who have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder of some sort. It's not a choice. These people who truly have the disorder cannot pay attention even if I give them $1 million. Their brain literally will not allow them to. At the same time, there are other reasons that affect all of us or other causes that can interfere with our ability to pay attention, such as the most common problem that interferes with individuals' ability to pay attention is basically lack of sleep. The average person needs between 6 and 8 hours of sleep a night. Individuals who get less sleep than that, including myself, it negatively impacts our attentional capacity. Another common referral question that ends up in my clinic is individuals, they have a child, and they're just concerned because of all the publication of attentional problems. They want what's best for their child, and they just want to do what's right. Having somebody assess a child, adolescent, or adult with the understanding of how the brain develops, what looks like normal attentional capacity as opposed to abnormal attentional capacity. For instance, for the most part, a three-year-old's attentional capacity is going to be much less than a six-year-old's. A six-year-old's ability to pay attention is going to be much less than a 10-year-old, and so on and so forth. So by the time an individual enters adulthood, we expect their attentional capacity to be a certain level. Another misnomer and common mistake that unfortunately occurs out there when attempting to diagnose whether or not somebody truly has attentional difficulties of any sort is when a person has lower cognitive functioning. So the average person has an IQ of 100. That's average. It's about 68% of us have an IQ within 100, some thereabouts. But if somebody has a cognitive disability, an old term for that is mental retardation, their attentional capacity is going to be problematic. And this really isn't an attentional problem, as opposed to it's just that's that person's capacity. Other issues or events that can negatively impact a person's ability to pay attention is if somebody has a head injury, if they've been in a bad car accident, they've been struck in the head, something of that nature. So it becomes very complicated diagnosing this procedure. I utilize a diagnostic interview with anybody who will talk to me. I do psychological tests. I also administer actually a computer test that actually quantifies or clarifies exactly what that attentional problem is compared to other people. So I have the person complete a video game that basically measures their ability to pay attention compared to other people their age. Of course, there's also many health difficulties that can negatively impact a person's attentional difficulty. So it can be, once again, it can be very problematic. Of course, emotional problems, depression, anxiety, just a person's oppositional behavior. They don't want to pay attention if it doesn't interest them. That's different than attentional problems. So let's see here. So with that, we're about ready to go into our first break. This is Dr. Stress with Family Sanity, and we'll return with pharmacist Ted Regalia to discuss some of the treatments for people who have a neurologically based attentional problem as opposed to the inability to pay attention as a result of choice. So with that being said, I think we should be going to break here.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
If you have any emotional, cognitive, family, or other relationship questions or concerns, please call Dr. Stress's Behavioral Health Response System to talk with Dr. Stress or one of the trained professional coaches at 1-877-238-2429 for a minimal fee. You are not alone. We are here to help. Additional information about the Behavioral Health Response System may be found at drstressassociates.com. Also, Dr. Stress's book, The Parenting Cookbook, Thoughts, Ingredients, and Suggestions to Be an Awesome Parent, A Guide to Raising a Successful Child, is available at amazon.com. Can Chinese medicine and Western medicine go hand in hand when you are seeking treatment or a path to better health?
Absolutely. Listen each week
for Sticking to the Point, Natural Medicine Radio with host Cheryl Hongzermeyer.
We'll explain Chinese medicine, including acupuncture, in easy-to-learn ways. We'll even spotlight certain conditions that don't have any diagnosis in the field of Western medicine.
Be sure to tune in every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
If you have a loved one that is undergoing treatment for substance abuse or mental illness, you owe it to them and yourself to tune in to One Hour at a Time with host Mary Woods. This compassionate and educational talk show will help you help those that you love by better understanding their condition and their personal recovery process. Tune in every Monday at 12 noon Pacific Time to One Hour at a Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Recovery begins this hour.
Step into a healthier you. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are tuned in to Family Sanity. To reach the show today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send us an email to familysanity@drstressassociates.com. That's familysanity@drstressassociates.com. Now, back to Family Sanity.
Hello, this is welcome back to Family Sanity, and I'm your host, Dr. Brian Stress. We have a couple guests with us today to discuss attention deficit disorder hyperactivity or without hyperactivity. And our first guest is Ted Regalia. Ted is an accomplished pharmacist of over 30 years of experience. He's worked with individuals one-to-one. As a retail pharmacist, he helps out in long-term care facilities such as nursing home. He's a highly respected professional. And one of the reasons that Ted and I know each other is Ted is absolutely holistic in his approach to disorders, even though he's probably one of the most knowledgeable individuals about pharmacy that I've ever had the pleasure of interacting with. So Ted doesn't look, even though Ted and I truly believe that medications are appropriate at times, we also believe that medications are not appropriate if not warranted. So Ted has a wonderful goal of helping people with understanding medications, and he's an asset of the behavioral health response system. So people can call and actually talk to Ted if they have questions about their medications and stuff, not only with mental health or attentional problems, but in general. So with that, Ted, thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stress, for those very, very kind words, and good morning. The medications play a very important role in treating ADHD, and we look at basically three groups of medications. We have the direct stimulants, and an example would be methylphenidate or amphetamine. We also have what I'll refer to as indirect stimulants, and those are pretty much the antidepressant class. Bupropion, even Strattera behaves like an antidepressant. And then I'm sorry, you had a question?
Yeah, I was just going to say, methylphenidate and the amphetamines, what's the most common one? Would that be Ritalin?
Ritalin would be a trade name of the methylphenidate. And there's a whole slew of other similar available drugs.
Okay.
Short-acting and long-acting, which we'll talk about later.
Sure.
And the last category would be something, for lack of a better term, we're going to call it an alpha-2 binder. It's specific to particular receptors in the brain. And an example of an alpha-2 binder would be guanfacine, originally a blood pressure medicine, but found to be effective in helping with ADHD as well.
Okay, so there's basically three types of medication classes that can help with somebody who truly has neurologically based attentional difficulties to improve their attention and possibly reduce their physical hyperactivity. Is that correct?
Yes, there are several other off-label or other medications that could theoretically be attempted, but the three I described are the primary routes for treatment.
Okay. Now, one of the questions that I get asked frequently by patients is whether or not these medications are addictive or not.
Well, the stimulants are listed as what's called by the DEA a Schedule 2 or Class 2 medication, And because of that high restriction, it's that way because of potential for abuse, even potential for diversion and street value.
So what you're saying is the stimulants, the methylphenidates, the amphetamines, the drugs like Ritalin, what are the other names of the amphetamines or methylphenidates that people might recognize?
Dextroamphetamine, which is dexedrine.
Yep.
And Ritalin, there's long-acting Ritalin or long-acting methylphenidate called Concerta. There's several others available.
Okay. When you say that they're class 2, that means that they're at risk of being abused, I guess?
Correct.
Okay, so if somebody were to abuse these medications, what kind of effect would it have on them?
The dextroamphetamine would be a good example. Many individuals enjoy the stimulation and, in some cases, slight euphoria that can accompany the use of a drug like an amphetamine.
Okay, it's speed.
It's an upper.
Yeah, it's an upper. It's speed. Would that be a common name for it? Maybe a non-clinical name?
Sure.
Okay, so people can take these medications. So even if they don't have attentional problems, it can give them a boost.
Yeah, it'd be more effective than a couple cups of coffee.
Cups of coffee. Very good. Okay, so with those, and you talked here recently, just a moment ago, you said long-acting. Do you want to explain that, please?
Yeah, the advantage of first of all, methylphenidate and amphetamine, these things are only going to last about 4 hours in the body, maybe 6 hours if you're lucky. So what happened is the pharmaceutical companies created slow-release or double-release mechanisms so that the medication can, in effect, last 8, 10, 12 hours. And that's good for a lot of reasons. If you're an ADHD patient in school, you don't want the medication running out and not working in the second half of your school day.
Right. I used to be a school psychologist, and I know there's some stigma that can be assigned to students if they have to go down to the nurse's office to get their pills.
Precisely.
Right. So the long-acting is a way maybe to avoid that?
Precisely.
You take
it in the morning, and it's still working by the end of the school day.
Yep. Okay.
So that's a major advantage to the long-acting.
Okay. When you said that without the long-acting, you said the medication can last 4 to 6 hours?
Yeah.
Okay.
Somewhere in that range.
So that can vary with each person, I would assume, based on some...
Their metabolism.
So yes. How fast their heart is beating and how fast their body processes the medication and stuff. But basically, after 4 to 6 hours, so we'll see their attention will actually increase... And then it'll slowly start to decrease as the medication wears off? Is that?
Sure. Basically, we look at an onset of action around 30 minutes. And then it'll peak around 2 or 3 hours and then start to go down eventually so that at the 4 and 6 hour mark, measurable differences can be noticed.
Right, and one of the things that I've done when assessing people is we actually test them on that computer task that measures their attention off medications, and then we have them take like a Ritalin or methylphenidate, and then we test them again maybe 20, 30 minutes later to see the effects of the medications. Does that make sense to you? Or
perfect sense.
Yeah.
Back at you. What did you find in your studies?
You know, interestingly, at least I find it interesting. We can see exactly how much that medication is improving their attentional capacity. For instance, if the person has 80% clinical profile, that means their profile is 80% like somebody with attentional problems. They take the medication, and all of a sudden, their profile is only 30% like a clinical profile. So we know that medication has increased their attentional capacity by 50%. So we can actually help the medical doctor titrate, either increase or decrease. What I also have noticed, unfortunately at times, is people have an attentional profile that's actually better than the average. So their attentional profile is like 70 or 80% better than the average person with normal attention. And then they've been